death knells ringing, when friends rejoice both far and near, how can I keep from singing? In prison cells and dungeons vile, our thoughts to them are winging, when friends by shame are undefiled, how can I keep from singing? Oh, my life flows.
John McCutcheon, he's going to be in Chico, and you don't want to miss him. He's coming on June 4th, and that is from a 1989 recording called Water from Another Time. Yeah, how can I keep from singing? And I just thought that would be a good song to start us off with today, since it seems like things keep getting more intense. I want to thank everybody who contributed to KZFR during the Peace and Justice programs that Robert Jones and I hosted. And I just want to read this list of just dear hearts. Vicki, Linda, Sue, Emily, Sars, Bill, Shakti, Leela, Serena, Patrick, Ellen, Carol, Brenda, Wheezy, Karen, Bonnie, John, Keitha, Elizabeth, Dawn, Maria, and Cece. Thank you so much for the work that you did to help us get our emergency preparedness plan in place. And please stay tuned to see this unfold. We're going to get a generator installation here on the roof on the Breslauer building, and also upgrades to the transmitter site in Magalia. Thanks to you and everybody who gave during the pledge drive. Thank you so very much. And I want to move right into my first interview. This is with a woman who whose voice you know pretty well. She's Diane Suzuki. She's the co-host of One World Music here on KZFR on alternating Wednesdays. And apparently she's dialed back a little bit during COVID, but she's still in here at least once a month. That program, 12:30 to 3 on Wednesdays, features indigenous, traditional, and contemporary world music from around the planet. Diane Suzuki is the coordinator of the Beyond Violence Alliance and a founding member of the Chico Concerned Citizens for Justice. You can hear her in the Peace and Justice Program archives from last week in an important interview that she did with Ann Polifka and my co-host Robert Jones discussing the militarization of Chico police. And we wanted to get together today because of this being Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, and we wanted to do a segment on Asian American history and current concerns. And I just wanted to let you know, I think is enough for now, that the AAPI, American Public Affairs Association, was founded in 2001 and has over 20 chapters in California. A chapter, they're called APAPA, thank you, opened in Oroville last month, the first chapter north of Sacramento, and Diane was recognized with a Community Outreach Award because she started an Asian support circle in Chico after the killing spree that took the lives of eight people, six of whom were Asian women who worked at spas in the Atlanta area in March of 2021. This event caused grief, trauma, and reflection throughout the country for many people, but also Asian Americans especially. Perhaps just a blip in the gun violence saga of America, but it is important, and it is important that we revisit this now and also and honor the AAPI Heritage Month, as we'll do today. Diane Suzuki, welcome to this show, to Peace and Justice. I'm glad to have you with me.
Thank you.
I know that you're third generation Japanese and your family's legacy has deeply affected you and informed your life. Can you begin by telling us about your heritage, your thoughts on the social construct of race, and also about the breakdown of AAPI people by ethnicity and the challenges of recognition?
Sure. Thank you. My ethnic background comes from Japan, the Fukushima province, that's on my father's side, and my mother's people are from Okinawa, which was colonized by Japan, controlled by the U.S., and then in 1972 returned back to Japan. Okinawans generally want American military bases off their island, demilitarized and decolonized. My grandparents, as children, may have had to wear signs around their necks that read, "I do not speak Okinawan," just like we've heard about Native American children had to do this in this country and Canada. So I'm just learning this, you know, probably the last few decades. I would ask people, or I would tell people I'm Japanese, and I'm all Japanese, and they'd say, "Well, where's your family from?" I say, "My father's from Japan, and my mother's from Okinawa," and then they would... Japanese people would say, "Oh, also," like they could see the Okinawan part. Probably my dark skin is part of it. But so I didn't realize this history of Okinawa, you know, maybe. Actually, I learned it in Hawaii, because in Hawaii they would really distinguish themselves as Okinawan Hawaiians. Mm-hmm. You know, they wouldn't say they're Japanese Hawaiian. Mm-hmm. So that led me to keep educating my own self about who I am. Yeah.
Unless you actually go there and experience those cultures, it must be really difficult to understand who you are just from sensing in yourself. I mean,
right.
You don't know.
So before we begin speaking about AAPI Heritage Month, I wanted to talk about race being a social construct. You know, we've been hearing about that, and when we talk about discrimination and stereotyping kinds of problems that Asian Americans experience, we need to talk about this. And I found this in Scientific America. It says, it reads, "Racial categories are weak proxies for genetic diversity and need to be phased out. Race is a social construct that has no biological variables. It's a human-invented classification system. It was invented as a way to define physical differences between people, but has more often been used as a tool for oppression and violence. Ethnic heritages have been a source of conflict and prejudice among those differing ethnicities." And then many of us rejoice in the diversity of our fellow humans. So that comes from that Scientific America. I thought that was really a good description. And there are 48 countries that are considered Asian countries. That's a lot. And 15 independent Pacific Island nations. And in addition, tens of thousands of islands and islets and atolls. So with all that diversity and multitudes of cultures, there are some problems of non-inclusion. And with the AAPI, the intent of AAPI is inclusion, but the impact can be long-term impact of erasure for Pacific Islanders. So the PI part of it gets subsumed. And I found this quote by a Pacific Islander that asked, "How do we have a multitude of representations and understanding so that nothing becomes the single story of our community?" I mean, again, like, it's so broad. AAPI is such a broad category.
Very.
Just like every other category. Again, like, it's just a social, these are just constructs.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we just have to understand that. I think we're evolving towards that understanding.
Yeah, and I think that's really important to bring up. I mean, just how broad that is. That is amazing. So, to narrow it down to our local opening here in April, the Butte County APAPA founding was captured on video and posted on Facebook, and there were some really important people who attended the event on April 23rd, who I wanted you to recognize, to tell us about. And I was so pleased. I watched that on Facebook because I didn't know, some of these people, and I just like, oh my goodness, what a treat that they were here, you know. But most people missed it. So tell us about some of the folks.
So I was invited to attend this opening of APAPA, which is a national organization, which I think you already said what it means. American Public Affairs Association, Asian American Public Affairs Association, and I knew I was receiving an award, but I really didn't even know what any of it was. And I went to the APAPA site, and there is a bill, and I'll talk about that later, to include AAPI education into the K-12 curriculum. So that's an important thing. So on my way, you know, I'm saying, what is this? And then we show up, and I see Shirley Weber is on the sign-in. I went, Shirley Weber, she's the California Secretary of State. And she is also one of my sheroes. She wrote the AB 392 that has to do with police use of force, and it's worded about it being only necessary. So it got watered down, but she is a very staunch police reform supporter, and so I've been following her. Anyway, so she walked in, and I went, Shirley Weber! I gave her a hug. She goes, she knew who I am? Well, she is the Secretary of State. Anyway, I got to hug her, too. So that was really just an honor.
I just wanted to say, what I love best about her is her talking about how she had taught ethnic studies and how, and just the way that she presented it, just she was so inclusive. I just have rarely found a person that is that home, that much at home in themselves and in the body of humanity, you know. She's so at home there.
Yes. And I don't know if you saw her story. They moved to California from the South. I don't know if it was Mississippi, somewhere. They had to move because her father was being threatened by lynching. And they had to abandon and just leave. So if you look in Wikipedia on Shirley Weber, it talks about her childhood. And then another man that is a hero of mine, and I preceded him in my receiving of the award, is Mr. Jim Tanimoto. And he is going to be turning 100 this year. And he is the last of the No-No Boys. I don't know if people know about who they were. But as I was researching all my life about my family being interned and in concentration camps from World War II, I was going, well, where were the activists? Where were the people that kind of resisted? And I didn't find much because most Japanese did not even talk about it.
Right.
I mean, I've been in some groups this past year, this winter, the Suru for Solidarity, and even just 3-4 generations, and all of us say that the elders that were in camps, didn't talk about it. We thought they were going to summer. They're talking about summer camp.
So tell us, you know, you've referred to the No-No Boys before, yeah. But there are two questions on the loyalty oath that people were expected to sign, but they were real catch-22 questions. Mm-hmm. Can you discuss mm-hmm. those so that our listeners understand this better? Mm-hmm.
So again, Mr. Tanimoto is the last of the No-No Boys, and a group of young Japanese men were asked to sign questions 27 and 28, the so-called loyalty questions on the application for leave clearance, it's called. And then those who answered no were segregated into Tule Lake, one of the other camps. Anyway, questions 27 and 28 read, are you loyal to the Emperor of Japan? And are you loyal to the United States? And they just said no. And so you can imagine how these young men felt. You know, most of them had never been to Japan, and they were locked up in a prison camp, American prison camp, just for being Japanese ancestry. So they, you know, young men will do that. Like, no, they'll be a little rebellious. So I don't know how many of them, but yeah, they're almost all gone now.
Right. Mm-hmm. And for the elders who had come from Japan, they wouldn't want to say no because maybe they were going to get deported and then they wouldn't be able to go back to Japan. I mean, they just really had people over a barrel with these questions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And because they were stigmatized, the No-No Boys, and they had a wide variety of reasons for their actions, like a no-no status was stigmatized after the war, and they continue to be reluctant to tell their stories. That's what's so great about Mr. Tanimoto. He started to tell his stories. There were a couple more, and the Museum of Anthropology at Chico State had a whole exhibit on the internments, the concentration camps, and Mr. Tanimoto was a featured speaker, and he's been to every 10 or 11 of the camps as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to ask you about your speech that you gave at the Butte County APAPA event, because I felt it really went straight into the issues that we wanted to discuss about somewhat about hate crimes and stereotyping. Can you talk about what you said at that event?
When I accepted the award for community outreach, it seemed, it's apropos. So after the Asian massacre, Asian spa workers were murdered, which is, I just didn't really feel like, I had one friend that reached out to me, and no one reached out to me. So then I thought I needed to reach out to the local Asian American community myself. So I made a list of all those Asian and Pacific Islander heritage folks that I knew, and I actually knew over 50 people, and I emailed people, invited them to meet as a support group. And during that time, that was when I got my second COVID shot, I was sitting there in the waiting, after getting the shot, and this white man walked by and said really loud to the whole room, it was a big room, we should send all the Chinese back who brought this virus to America. And I was going, that's it. I mean, I was just laying tired from the, I had fatigue from the COVID, and I was mad. Anyway, so that, it just activated me. I am an activist, so that makes sense just to activate. So what we do is we gather in Cedar Grove and share experiences with each other about being Americans of Asian and Pacific Islanders descent. And we talk about how Asians are stereotyped as the model minority and as AAPI, as perpetual foreigners, and we're also used as a wedge between black and white people. I've always fought that model minority stereotype, and that's part of my being an activist and trying to speak out. What I said in the little acceptance speech was, overt attacks on Asians are on the rise across this country, and Americans of Asian descent and racism is alive in this country, from overt attacks to microaggressions, such as just statements like, ooh, you speak such good English, or you speak without an accent. So where are you really from? I mean, this still happens. I mean, just a month ago, somebody came up to me, and actually she thought I was Native, and she said, what tribe are you from? I mean, she just interrupted a conversation I was having, and then she started, touching my skin. Oh, you have such beautiful skin. I was like, oh, my God, back off. It was really weird, and that was just a month ago. So it just continues to happen. She wasn't mean. It was just weird. Anyway, so our group explores some of these kinds of hurtful behaviors to support one another, and hopefully to boost our well-being in doing so. And that's how I ended it.
So that makes me really uncomfortable. I don't even know where to begin about asking you to tell me how to challenge stereotyping and bias. But I know that you've been a student of, you've worked with Color Change, with the Beyond Violence Alliance, you have spent years of your life working against racism, and I was wondering if you, maybe tell us about this book that you had recommended by Grace Chow, Tastes Like War. What are your thoughts about white people educating themselves?
Well, I recommend this book because it does give really big insights. I mean, I learned so much by this book. And It Tastes Like War refers to this powdered milk that her mother had to drink during the American-Korean War. And so that's where that comes from. And this book covers the intersection of war, race, prostitution, Asian stereotyping, and mental illness. And she talks about how her mother's mental illness comes from all that trauma that she experienced, which is, I think, something right now we're really trying to understand, what is mental illness? at least I am, or all this trauma informed and intergenerational trauma or epigenetic trauma that we inherit, and that really actually does inform almost everything I do. I realize, my activism comes from the trauma that my ancestors have experienced. So I don't know, it feels like good work when I do that. But the book, she writes beautifully about, Grace Cho writes beautifully about her mother's trauma of that war and being rescued by an American soldier. So they come and he brings them, her and her mother, to a small town where she and her mother experience really awful racism and xenophobia. I mean, it was way worse than I've ever experienced. So just give me a little perspective. It could have been worse. They went to a small town in Washington. Wow. Anyway, and they were the only Asians in their town, in their area.
And I just wanted to add a couple of things about history, because we wanted to talk about history. This started for Chinese people in the mid-1800s. They came here seeking a better life like everybody else, and they worked on the railroads. They helped build this country just like, other immigrants did. But in 1882, Congress passed the Chinese Exclusion Act, which was the first major law that restricted immigration into the U.S., and that wasn't repealed until 1943. And then we talked a little bit about the internment camps, which Franklin Roosevelt set up by executive order in 1942 after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and it removed any person considered a threat to U.S. security. But it was just it affected profoundly Japanese Americans. 120,000 Japanese Americans who were put into internment camps, especially in the West. And then there was something called the Asiatic Barred Zone Act, which is in 1917, there was an immigration act that looked to curb how many citizens were allowed to enter the U.S., and it basically barred all immigrants from the Middle East and Southeast Asia from entering the U.S. And then there was a quota system in 1924 that determined the racial composition of the country, pretty much that the country stayed white until 1965, when the Immigration and Nationality Act was passed by Lyndon Johnson. And that essentially eliminated all the quota laws and opened up merit-based immigration system focused on reuniting families, attracting skilled labor, assisting refugees suffering from violence and unrest. And that has led us into the current era, where we've seen the value of finally the melting pot, where you're here, but we're also trying to determine, who we are, who we want to be, and how we relate to one another. So I just wanted to include that little bit of history before.
Mm-hmm. And there was no intermarriage either.
Miscegenation, between 60s, races.
Was it? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Definitely, even in the 60s, because I had friends that married and they were, breaking the law. Mm-hmm. So with a moment we have left, I wanted to ask you also about Fred Korematsu. I know he's been important to you.
Mm-hmm. And before we do that, I just wanted also just to cite about the vice principal locally in Chico.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I don't want to forget that.
Thank you.
At Rosedale, who got fired for teaching equity studies. She was an equity leader, and she was placed on administrative leave because some parents were making a lot of noise. So it's right here. It's right in our community. It's it's a macrocosm always, but
And you can read about that case in chicosoul.org.
Yeah. About Miss Campos.
Mm-hmm.
So Fred Korematsu, he decided, he told his parents, he was a young man, he just said to his parents, I didn't do anything wrong, I'm not going to go into prison, into the camps. And his parents go, you make your own decision. You know, we're going, we got to pack up things. And, you know, they just had a certain amount of time and go into these camps with what they could carry. So he got caught. And then a couple of ACLU attorneys took his case to the Supreme Court, but he lost. And then he had to go to camp anyway. And in camp, he was ostracized. And he was, again, one of those people that didn't talk about it. His kids did not know about it, that this happened. And his daughter came home one day, and somebody in class had written a story about her father. And it said Cora Monson. And she was thinking, oh, it must be my uncle. No, and her student friend said, no, this is your dad. She's going, no. He never told us anything about this. She ran home and asked her dad, and her mother was only home, so her mother explained to her what that was about. But he was ostracized. He was shamed, you know. So that was. But there's a Fred Korematsu Day celebrating his birthday in the end of January, and I try to always do something in his honor. But what was interesting during that time was a Supreme Court Justice Frank Murphy dissented in the case. In his case, the Korematsu case, declaring, I dissent from this legalization of racism, and that was making it the first Supreme Court opinion ever to use the word racism. So I always thought that was interesting. And then on last year, Representative Mark Takano, he's a Democrat from California, reintroduced the Korematsu Takai Civil Liberties Protection Act to prohibit the imprisonment or detainment of American citizens solely on the basis of race, religion, nationality, sex, gender identity. And this is still on the books. This is still on the books. Anyone can be in prison for being those identities. Oh, and Chris is the one who reminded me, because I mean, I've been tracking it, but I didn't track it this past year. So it's still on the books. It's just amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing to me that you can't be detained or imprisoned just because of you're perceived to be something by your race, ethnicity, national origin, religion, gender, identity, or sexual orientation. They just judge you for whatever they want.
Yeah.
we need better protections, not just for privacy, but for identity.
Yeah.
I want to thank you so much, Diane You're Suzuki, welcome. For being my guest today on the Peace and Justice program. I want to urge everyone to listen in on Wednesdays to One World Music and to hear your blend of wonderful, wonderful selections. I always love your show. Thank
that
you.
That opens the mind. That opens the heart.
That's right.
World music.
It does. World music.
Mm-hmm.
It's where it's at.
Thank you.
Thank you. Peace to you. I want to shift gears, as we always have to do on this show. It's always so hard, but I want to thank our underwriters at this point. I want to thank Patrick Riley, a real estate professional with Century 21 Select, specializing in properties in Chico and Butte Meadows. Patrick is dedicated to helping buyers and sellers achieve their real estate goals with kind, quality service. Patrick can be reached at 588-6593 and on Facebook. And by Quicksilver Courier Service. Established in 2010, Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services for private individuals, as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit ChicoCourier.com for quality 24/7 delivery service. Also want to thank, let you know about the Mother's May I Sip and Shop, a pop-up market with local makers and creatives in celebration of Mother's Day on Saturday, May 7th, 12 to 5 at Lassen Traditional Cidery, 643 Entler Avenue. Vendors include art, jewelry, local products, tarot readings, and more, as well as Lassen Traditional Ciders, Harvester Food Truck, and Chico Velo, which will provide complimentary valet bike parking. Details are at turkeytailfarm.com. Lastly, I want to thank the Bankruptcy Law Offices of Michael O. Hayes, a proud supporter of community radio. Michael O. Hayes offers complimentary consultations and payment plans for Chapter 7 and 13 bankruptcies. For more information, visit chicobk.com or at 530-892-8255. 8916. So it's noon straight up. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico. Listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. The opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, or underwriters, just mine and my guests. And let's go on. I would like to play a little mamuse for you. They played at a benefit for Aqua Alliance on this weekend, this last weekend, to save our groundwater. And they're so amazing, and so I wanted to just play you one of their songs. In this one, the acoustics may not be as good as usual because they're sitting by the Rogue River when they're singing this one, but it's called We Shall Be Known. One thing I wanted to let you know, too, is that they're going to be part of a Sisters in Harmony Global online event on May 9th at 4 p.m., and you can get tickets for that at Eventbrite. So support Mamuse as they supported our local water. So I'm going to get my next guest on the line. Here is Mamuse.
We shall be known by the company we keep, by the ones who circle round to tend these fires. We shall be known by the ones who sow and reap the seeds of change alive from deep within the earth. It is time now. It is time now that we thrive. It is time we lead ourselves into the well. It is time now. And what a time to be alive. In this great turning, we shall learn to lead in love. In this great turning, we shall learn to lead in love. We shall be known by the company we keep, by the ones who circle round to tend these fires. We shall be known by the ones who sow and reap the seeds of change alive from deep within the earth. It is time now. It is time now that we thrive. It is time we lead ourselves into the well. It is time now.
All right, Mamuse, we shall be known. I have my next guest on the line. His name is John Lindsay Pollan. He's a writer, activist, researcher, and analyst focused on human rights and demilitarization, especially in the Americas. He's currently co-director of the California Healing Justice Program of the American Friends Service Committee with a focus on police demilitarization. He has written about, researched, and organized action for human rights and demilitarization of U.S. policy in Latin America for 30 years. He coordinates Stop U.S. Arms to Mexico, a project of global exchange. From 1989 to 2014, he served the Interfaith Pacifist Organization Fellowship of Reconciliation as coordinator of the Task Force on Latin America and the Caribbean, as research director and founder for FOR's Colombia Peace Team. From 2003 to 2014, he also edited a monthly newsletter focused on Colombia and U.S. policy and the Latin American Update. I want to welcome you, John Lindsay Pollan, to the Peace and Justice Show. Thanks for being with me today. Hi.
Hi. It's great to be with you, Chris.
Yeah, I really appreciate the help that you gave to all the local activists who are working on the AAB 481 project of trying to get the military, demilitarization of the Chico Police Department, And just wanted to say to our listeners that Diane Suzuki, who was just with me here in the studio, was last week on Robert Jones' Peace and Justice program when he interviewed Diane and Ann Polifka regarding our local efforts to demilitarize the Chico Police Department. And John Lindsay Polland, in his work with the American Friends Service Committee, has developed a toolkit which helped our local efforts in response to new legislation called AB 4081, which requires each law enforcement agency's governing body to adopt a written military use policy by ordinance in a public forum in order to continue the use of previously acquired military equipment. And that's set to go into effect on May 1st, and it did. But you recently wrote an article on May 2nd, John Lindsay Polland, about the states, more than a third of California's 20 largest law enforcement agencies have not complied with the new state law that requires police and sheriff departments to post information and propose use policies for the militarized equipment and weaponry they own by May 1st. Can you tell us what the status of the police departments around California is in regards to this requirement?
Well, first, I can just say why this requirement, because I think some people are questioning it.
Thank you.
And, you know, we saw in 2020 in many parts of the country and for many years, many communities have seen how police have become more militarized. They've gone into more of a warrior stance, often see the community as an enemy, as a danger, and then treat the community as such. And the posture of a military for warfare is really different from the posture of an entity that is simply enforcing the law. Even if we just see the police in their historical role, which is really, you know, it comes out of a very out of slave patrols, out of anti-labor demonstrations and repression. And so the role of policing historically has been one to preserve the status quo, preserve power relationships that exist within our communities and in our society. And so as in recent decades, police have acquired more, not just equipment from the military, from the Department of Defense, but have taken on more tactics, more attitudes. The culture has become more insular. The training is more militarized. And as that has occurred, it's really harder for police to treat community members as fellow community members. So this bill, AB 41, was designed to, first of all, make more transparent what is the militarized equipment that police have and use, and not just what comes from the Pentagon, but because for community members, it doesn't really matter whether it came from the Department of Defense or if they acquired it commercially. If it's a very militarized approach to the community, it has the same impact if you're the subject of it. So the transparency is central to this legislation because most communities have no idea what kind of arsenals police and sheriffs have, and neither do elected officials. And so this gives elected officials an opportunity, and law enforcement agencies themselves too, to not just disclose what types of equipment they have, but how it should be used, which is a community elected body law enforcement conversation, right? A lot of people do think that if there's an active shooter situation, that there should be certain types of equipment available to police. But then the question becomes, okay, are you going to use that for peaceful protests? Are you going to use it in public relations activities? Are you going to use it when you serve a warrant for a drug search, to search for illegal narcotics? Those are questions that are important to have really have the conversation about them. And this law requires law enforcement agencies to publish what they have, propose use policies, when is use authorized, and then elected officials in public hearings approve, amend, or deny. None of them have denied anything yet. The equipment that law enforcement has put forward. And so the law made a May 1st deadline. It came into effect January 1st, and it created a May 1st deadline for the equipment that police and sheriff's departments already have. And what are we talking about? What types of equipment? We're talking about armored vehicles, tank-like vehicles. We're talking about assault rifles, tear gas, and other chemical agents, so-called less lethal launchers, beanbag, munitions, rubber bullets, that type of thing, drones, robots, breaching equipment that's used to blow open door, things like that. And as of May 1st, we've been trying to track the more than 100 police and sheriff agencies in the state and which ones are posting. They're required under the law to post these policies on the law enforcement agency's website by May 1st. And we found that, yes, as you said, of the 20 largest agencies, 7 of them did not post by May 1st. Since then, a couple of those 7 have. But some of the largest ones have not. So San Francisco Police Department, San Francisco Sheriff's Office, Los Angeles Sheriff's Office, Long Beach just posted last night. So some of these very large departments, San Jose Police Department, had not posted their use policy. So they're either taking longer or they're ignoring it, or it's not entirely clear why they didn't meet that deadline when all these other agencies did. And then with at least 30 days after that, there will be, or in some many places there already has, as in Chico, a public hearing with the governing body, the city council, or the county supervisors, to discuss, to hear from law enforcement and have a chance for the public to weigh in and say, we don't want that, we do want that, or only for this use, or we want more information about this. And that's kind of what the law is for and what the current status is.
Yeah, unfortunately in Chico, sometimes it falls on deaf ears. Nothing that we said seemed to ripple the water at all. But last week you delivered a letter endorsed by more than 70 organizations to over 2,500 city and county officials across the state. Can you tell us about that? How are cities opposing militarization of their police and responding to new legislation? Have there been any successful campaigns?
Yes, sorry, I answered that last question. We sent by email, we got an email list of all the different city council members and city attorneys and county supervisors and county councils, raising a number of concerns about some of the military equipment policies that have already been posted that don't conform with the AB 41 law. A number of city council members in different places responded to us, and there have also been community efforts in a number of different communities. So, and they don't always, I would say, have an effect on the vote by the governing body, but they become part of the public conversation, which I do think is very important. In Santa Cruz, the police department did not include assault rifles in their policy, even though they have them. And in fact, the Santa Cruz police not only have assault rifles, but they are standard issue for every officer, which is an exemption within the state law. If a weapon is a standard issue, a rifle is a standard issue, then it doesn't have to be included in the use policies. But then that raises the question, why does every officer in Santa Cruz, which is not known for having a worse public safety situation than other communities, why does every officer there have an assault rifle as a standard issue weapon when many surrounding communities and other communities around the state don't consider, have not made them standard issue? Why is Santa Cruz more militarized? So in the end, there were many people who commented publicly at the city council meeting, and the city council decided to add assault rifles to the use policy that the police department must submit, even though technically, according to the state law, because they're standard issue, they wouldn't have, the police department wouldn't have to. So that was an important precedent, I think, both because the community really at, and because an elected body said, you know, regardless of what the law says, this is a piece of equipment that's of concern to us, to as elected officials and for the community. And we want transparency on it. We want a use policy on it. In Hayward, the Hayward Community Coalition organized a public comments, and people said a lot of different things, very informed, very including regarding a killing of someone in Hayward by Hayward Police Department. Family members were there. And the public said, we have a scorecard here, and we want you to give instructions to the police department to revise this proposed policy. And we're going to be grading you. We're going to be scoring you, elected officials. Here's my scorecard. So I'll be
great idea
you when you comment. And it's a really a way to hold elected officials accountable. I think a lot of times people want to bring this to the police, but I really think the biggest abdication has been by civilians who keep giving more authority to police, more responsibility to police. I mean, police are now responsible for homelessness and drug use and mental illness and school discipline and natural disaster response and things that really police are not designed for. And so I that's a civilian responsibility to reassign those responsibilities and fund the responsibilities in civilian agencies, non-police agencies.
Yeah.
So holding those elected folks accountable is super, super critical.
Yeah, and folks, if you want to be involved in this, the local CC4J, Concerned Citizens for Justice group, is on Facebook, and it's called Concerned Citizens for Justice Chico, or the website is cc4jchico.org, and you can find out all the information also from the toolkit. I'm speaking with John Lindsay Poland, and he designed this toolkit with American Friends Service Committee, the California Healing Justice Program, it's called. And John, I would like to ask you to, because this is what kind of eats at me, is that what is the next step? What happens next year? I mean, I think that we got a glut of military stuff after the end of the Afghanistan war here, and maybe that's why there was such a big bump in what they got, or maybe, like they said, well, we already had this stuff anyway, but what can we do next year? Isn't there another review that's needed?
This is an annual process. And I think it was hard to be prepared this year because it was there was so little notice. I mean, yes, these things were put on websites for 30 days, but typically in very obscure parts of the website. And next year and a year, each police department will have to report on how they use this stuff. And the use reports, I'm anticipating some of them will not be super informative. A lot of them will, you know, I think one of the important pieces here is how policing in general and militarized policing specifically really impacts people of color disproportionately, impacts mentally ill people disproportionately, impacts youth disproportionately.
Homeless people.
Homeless people. And so how has this been used, I think, is going to be a real important question to ensure that the department reports on. And so telling them in advance, we want to know what are the parts of the community that were impacted by this? Because law enforcement generally talks about the most extreme situations, right, where people can sympathize. Okay, there was this very, very dangerous situation, and we brought in this equipment. And most people will be like, okay, yeah, I get that. But how is it used most of the time? How? What are the other situations in which it was used? Was it used in ways that some of us at least might think are inappropriate or harmful? And if so, that should change the use policy. That should restrict the use policy.
Mm-hmm.
But that requires some organizing in advance, and I think letting the media, letting the elected officials, and letting law enforcement know that this is important to community members, that you're watching, that you want regular updates, I think would be really important.
Yeah, and I like that idea of the scorecards. It's something we could do. I wanted to ask you, we have less than 5 minutes left, and I wanted to find out for our listeners about the organizations you work with, because there's a big picture here of gun violence, and it's an international picture. And can you tell us about the work of California Healing Justice Program and also Stop U.S. Arms to Mexico, the two programs that you're involved with, and how they kind of interface?
Well, you know, I've been working for a few decades on issues of militarism and human rights. So that's, for me, that's the intersection. Those things are living in two different organizations. In American Friends Service Committee, we are working to reduce the footprint and the impact and the resources, shift the resources from the punishment system, from the carceral system, of which police are a part, into healing systems, things that are starving of resources, whether that's housing or mental health or substance use treatment, education, like all of these different pieces that when we don't have them, we feel insecure, and it often makes us less stable. It can lead us to transgress against other people. And so that's a lot of what we're working on within California. There's other American Friends Service Committee is an international Quaker peace and justice organization. And so we work on these issues in other parts of the country and the world as well. And then the Stop U.S. Arms to Mexico project is a project of the human rights group Global Exchange. And that project focuses on reducing the flow of firearms, both illegal and legally exported for the drug war, from the United States to Mexico. Because U.S. firearms are creating a crisis here within the United States, but they're also generating a crisis within Mexico, probably even more homicides committed with U.S.-sourced firearms in Mexico than in all of the United States. And so we're working with Mexican organizations as well as U.S. gun violence prevention groups and immigrant rights groups to reduce that flow, again, the illegal trafficking that's going over the border from gun shops and gun shows, as well as legally exported weapons that are going to police and military in Mexico and often being used against communities. So, you know, I'm a researcher and an advocate and an organizer, and so that's kind of the role that I play in both of those campaigns.
Yeah, and I heard you at a panel in Nogales when we were there for the School of the Americas program that went on with a lot of teach-ins, and I was very, very impressed with the data you were collecting from all over the place and the people that, you know, that spoke there. And I guess this is a network to prevent gun violence in the Americas, and I'm really pleased, but I would like it if our listeners knew how they could be involved more on this big picture issues, because it's only seems to be worsening.
Yes, and you know, for me, engagement is a part of my mental health, you know, and in a context where things are worsening.
Mm-hmm.
People can connect with the Stop U.S. Arms to Mexico project at our website, which is stopusarmstomexico.org. And or on the California policing issues, afsc.org/California-militarized-police. So again, it's afsc.org/California-militarized-police. And we've done a recent report called Equipped for War, and as you mentioned, there's an advocacy toolkit and there's an interactive map of data that people can connect with.
And, you know, I hope that we can get you up to Chico. I think that it would be so good for us to be able to put our heads together with somebody who could really, like, pull all the tools out of the toolbox. Police are always talking about, we need these things in our toolbox. Well, peace activists also need toolboxes.
Absolutely,
that are full.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for being a guest today, John Lindsay Pollan. And thank you for your many years of incredible work. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chris, and I hope we'll get to connect again soon.
All right. Peace. Bye.
Bye.
All right, folks. We are going to go to my next guest in a moment. I wanted to let you know a couple of things that are going on in the community, and one of them is there was a wonderful women's reproductive rights March this week, and there will be another one. I believe it's the 14th. Don't have that in front of me, but there was a save the date that I wrote down somewhere and not seeing, but that's coming up. We have to stand up for reproductive rights, and one of the ways to do that, of course, is that people who support our rights need to be elected into Congress during the midterm elections, and this is extremely important. We also are going to need in California support for our clinics, because there will be a huge onslaught of women requiring care, and so please support our local clinics in any way that you can, because they are going to really need to hire more staff, to have longer hours. We have to respond in kind to the women who need us. So that's one thing. And then also there's a there's an International Day of Action on Saturday, and at the Chico Peace Endeavor Vigil, which is at 12:30 to 1:30 at the corner of 3rd and Main on Saturday, there will be a rally against the war in Ukraine. And if you could bring your own sign, that'd be great, or you can use one of ours. But this is part of a larger action around the world to move this deepening and very serious war into negotiations and ceasefire. And then lastly, I wanted to mention that activists go with Occupy Beale every month to Beale Air Force Base to stand against war and against drone assassinations and the surveillance and targeting of individuals, which happens from Beale Air Force Base. And so we will be there on Thursday, May 12th, from 3 to 5 p.m. And there is a Facebook page called Occupy Beale where you can get more information. But I would love it if more people from our area in Northern California would come to Beale Air Force Base, which is right outside of Marysville, in order to participate in standing for peace. And, you know, one thing that I'm always amazed at is how many of the military people give us a peace sign, wave at us. I think that they don't want war either. Lastly, I want to wish, if I forget, I want to wish you all a happy Mother's Day, all of you who are either mothers or children of mothers, that we remember Julia Ward Howe, and that this holiday was originally an anti-war holiday where women came together to oppose war. So this is a good time to remember what it means to the preciousness of all of our children around the world. I'm going to get my next guest on the line. I'm going to give you a little Michael Franti. This is an old song, but it's I think you'll recognize it. You can bomb the world to pieces, but you can't bomb it into peace.
behind the colors that you fly. Love just one nation. In the whole world we divide. You say you're sorry. There is no other choice. God bless the people now who cannot raise their voice. We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa.
All right, still true. And you can see that in Ukraine. It is not working. All right, so I have on the line with me Don Kimball. He's a U.S. Air Force veteran. He was in the military from 77 to 81. He served as an air traffic controller in the Strategic Air Command. Then he spent 25 years after that involved in the aviation industry. He started in radio in 1972, and then he graduated from the Brown Institute of Broadcasting in 1975. And he's been the host of a show called Friendly Fire, a voice for veterans, since 2017, which broadcasts 3 times a week in Maine and New Mexico. He's an advocate for veterans, but also for peace. And Don was going to be my guest last week, 2 weeks ago, when we had the pledge drive, and we were unable to connect because he was driving across the country from Creech Air Force Base, where he had been involved in the shutdown Creech protests, and just couldn't quite coordinate it. So anyway, welcome, Don Kimball, to the Peace and Justice Program. I'm so happy to finally get you on the show.
Chris, it's a real pleasure to be here, and thank you for the work that you do and your show. People like you, shows like yours, stations like yours are so very important right now when the truth, of course, is always the first casualty of war, and we've got a war going on in Ukraine right now, and it may be a proxy war, but it's still a war, and it looks like it could get even worse. There doesn't seem to be anybody that's in charge. I mean, the Pope has tried to interject his point of view with Putin, but from what I'm hearing, Putin didn't even get back to him. I'm not a huge fan of the Vatican or Pope or the Catholic Church, but still, if somebody could, you know, bring some sanity to this, call for a ceasefire, this is what we need. We need to sit down, we need to talk, we need to stop killing people, and it's not happening, Chris.
Right. And, you know, I listened, you did a show earlier today. I don't know if you had previously broadcast or if it was live, but it was with Linda Pence Gatner from Beyond Nuclear. And I felt such a kinship with you. She was saying such important things about the nuclear power plants in Ukraine. And I've covered that, too. I mean, people need to be aware of how quickly this can escalate, and I don't really think they understand that. And I was wondering if you want to relate anything from what you learned today from your guests, because I'm always learning things from my guests.
Yeah, Linda Pence Gutner of Beyond Nuclear is just an awesome spokesperson for her group and an advocate for peace and anti-nuclear activist, trying to bring some sanity to the nuclear problems that we have right now. And as we talked about today, and before I forget, if listeners want to tune into that show, and I don't want to take them away from KZVR, but that show's rebroadcast again Sunday on gmcr.org, Sunday at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, and gmcr.org, Sunday at 6 p.m. And yeah, she talked about there's 15 nuclear power plants in Ukraine, and one of them is Chernobyl, which everybody knows about. Even though Chernobyl is decommissioned, it is still a real danger. And then the largest nuclear reactor in all of Europe is down in the, and Chernobyl's up in the northwest corner of Ukraine, only 60 miles from Kiev. And Zaporozhye, I believe is how you pronounce it. Can we have a war somewhere with the names of countries that names that I can pronounce? No, I'm kidding. Is down in the south eastern corner, and right now that is being the operations are being run by the Ukrainian operators, but they are under Russian guns. In other words, Russia occupies that plant now. As Linda talked about, most people saw a few weeks ago when that plant was struck by a couple of missiles. And fortunately, the word is that it just hit administrative buildings and that no reactors were damaged. Now, that's probably true, and we hope it's true. But again, the first casualty of war, truth, and the nuclear industry on its own is very, very secretive from its inception. And perhaps it had to be then, but they've kept that secrecy ever since the Trinity bomb was exploded in southern New Mexico way back in 42. So it's hard to get the truth out of folks. And for those of you who've read Naomi Klein's Shock Doctrine, Chris, here we are again. This is planned. The capitalists plan this stuff. We have no more State Department to negotiate. All we have is the Defense Department that wants to bomb and that wants more money for the defense contractors. Look at President Biden. He looks like a bozo going to Alabama and talking to workers at a plant that are making Javelin missiles. Javelin missiles that could destroy Russian tanks. I mean, he's even talked about the number of bullets that we've sent to Ukraine. He's a spokesperson for the defense contractors and the defense industry, and that's pretty much where we're at. I mean, you know, have you heard anybody, Chris, say that they want to talk about a ceasefire at all?
No, just myself and a few others like you. So, Don Kimball, I wanted to ask you about some of the work that you've done. I know that one of the passions of your life is to stand up for whistleblowers, and one of the people is Daniel Hale, and when we talk about truth and we talk about secrecy, Daniel Hale apparently exposed the information about the U.S. drone assassination program in Yemen, Somalia, and Afghanistan during the Obama administration in 2015, and he did plead guilty to a single count under the Espionage Act in 2021, and then he was sentenced to 45 months in prison. What was your reaction to that, and why is it so important what Daniel Hale did, and what can we do about it?
Daniel Hale, a true American hero, serving 45 months in the Marion prison in Marion, Illinois. And Chris, before we leave today, make sure I give everybody the mailing address to write to Daniel, because those letters are so important. I've written him three times since he's been incarcerated. I've only heard back once, but we need to continue to support him and let him know that he is thought about, that he's cared, that he's loved, and that we want him out. We continue to, every show I have, I ask people to, you know, write to Daniel. I ask the people to ask President Biden to pardon Daniel Hale. And he is a true American hero. He should get a medal for what he did. And he exposed the United States drone assassination program, extrajudicial killings of mostly innocents. He's the one that exposed in 1 5-month period. There was a 90% of the people that were killed by the drones were innocent, 90%. And in just the first year of his administration, Trump killed more people, including 250 children, with drones in Yemen and Pakistan than President Barack Obama did in 8 years. And that was from the People's World. Absolutely incredible statistics. The United States continues this program. I think one of the biggest reasons, Chris, that I advocate so much for Daniel, there are several reasons. One is I'm former Air Force now. I only did 4 years, but still, you know, I guess there's some kind of a solidarity there with another Air Force person. And two, I'm worried about blowback. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's college freshmen now that are going to school that weren't born, Chris, when 9/11 happened. 2001 it happened. So we've got college freshmen now that weren't even around. So do they know, I'm sure they know about it, but do they know why the World Trade Centers were taken down? Do they know why the Pentagon had a aircraft crash into it? Do we know why another aircraft went down in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, the famous phrase, let's roll? That was blowback from Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda in Arabic is the base. That was Osama bin Laden's revenge for our war in Iraq. That's blowback. And if you don't think there's people out there that are planning something like this because of what America's doing right now, then think again. They're out there, and they're thinking about it, and it could happen again. And another reason I'm so invested in this, Chris, is I actually worked for United Airlines then. I actually was on the aircraft that hit, the second aircraft to hit United 175. I was part of that crew the night before. We brought that aircraft into Boston Logan Airport the night of September 10th. Hmm. And the very next crew was murdered.
Oh.
I knew all those people.
Oh, I didn't know that. I'm sorry.
Well, I appreciate that, and how could you know unless I told you? But it's personal.
Mm-hmm.
I know for a fact about blowback because my company, my friends, my coworkers were murdered by terrorists who were getting blowback because of America's actions. So Daniel's just, you know, pointing out what's happening, and we're trying to say, you know, he's right. This needs to stop for many reasons, and one of them is blowback. And I was fortunate enough to be able to go to Daniel's sentencing last July 28th was when he was sentenced last year. Some of the speakers at the press conference afterwards were CIA whistleblower and author John Kiriakou, whistleblower lawyer Jesslyn Raddick, Chip Givens of Defending Rights and Dissent, Assistant Federal Public Defender Cadence Mertz, and Code Pink co-founder Medea Benjamin. The government had asked for 9-year sentence for Daniel.
Mm.
And Daniel ended up getting 45 months, which is a victory in a way. I mean, he never should have been in jail in the first place. But it was a slap in the face to the government and to the prosecutors, I think, by the judge. Here they were asking for 9 years. Daniel got 45 months. But a couple things, Chris, about Daniel. One is the way he was sentenced. He was sentenced under this, and I think Lisa Ling, another drone whistleblower who's in the Air Force, who was also featured in the movie, the documentary, National Bird, right, which is about the drone program. Sonia Kennebec's Bird, I think it was out in 2016. You know, the Espionage Act was created to prosecute spies back in World War One, 1917, Espionage Act, okay? The government has taken that and weaponized it in using it against whistleblowers. This law was never intended for anything like that. So this is it's a travesty of justice in so many ways. One, that law was used to prosecute Daniel. And two, he's being held in the Marion prison in a communications management unit, which is meant for terrorists. So the terrorists can't network with each other as well. So both these things, you know, have affected Daniel's life significantly, and he really is at risk. His mental health isn't good. Of course, as you know, and most of the listeners know, that a lot of the people that are in the drone program suffer from PTSD because it's just such a terrible thing that they have to do. Mm-hmm. If I don't know if folks saw the article in the New York Times, April 15th, 2022, about Air Force Captain Kevin Larson.
Right.
And here's this guy, you know, another all-American, you know, hero who you know, went rogue because he just couldn't take it anymore. And like you said, I was out at Creech for the semi-annual shutdown, Creech run by Coat Pink and other groups that come and go, Veterans for Peace, Band Killer Drones, Nevada Desert Experience. And we go there to, for many reasons. One is to witness, two is to remember. This time we had a very, very moving action that was about the Ahmadi family. And the Ahmadi family, of course, was that family of 10 that was killed last year in the last gasp of the Afghanistan war by the U.S. military, a family of 10, 7 children that were innocent. And even though the Pentagon said a day or two after the strike that it was a righteous strike, a week later they had to walk all that back because it was anything but. It was murder. It was murder of 10 people, 7 of them children. The government has, the United States government has promised restitution, and they've promised that the family could immigrate to the United States. As far as I know, this has not happened. Legendary activists like Kathy Kelly would probably be able to speak to that better than I, or the wonderful author Ann Jones, author of Winter in Kabul, and also They Were Soldiers. And, you know, I've been doing friendly fire going on almost 5 years now. And I thought, you know, I've got my finger on the pulse of what's happening here and stuff. But until you read that Ann Jones, They Were Soldiers, because she embeds herself with the military in Afghanistan. She follows the cases of the soldiers who are wounded from the very first time that they get into the field hospital, over to Ramstein, over to Walter Reed, into rehab. Mm-hmm. It's heartbreaking and incredible stories that she tells. And, you know, she talks about many things. She talks about veteran suicide. And you know, this drone program, while it's killing innocents overseas, it's also killing our troops, our men and women in service. An average of 17 to 22 service members, veterans, commit. Well, you know, we don't say commit anymore. We say choose death by suicide every single day.
Wow.
Take out your calculator, listeners, and multiply that times 20 years and see what figure you come up with. It's staggering. It's mind-blowing. It's unacceptable, and it has to stop. But it's not going to stop until we stop things like this drone program. And, of course, we all saw what's happened on the USS George Washington lately. More suicides on a navy ship. You know, what is it about the service that's driving our young men and women, some of our best and brightest, to such depths of despair that they're choosing to end their own young lives? It's tragic in so many ways. But back to Daniel. So Daniel's serving a 45-month sentence, and if I can, Chris, I'll read the address to write to him now, if that's okay.
Yeah, please.
So it's Daniel E. Hale, H-A-L-E. And by the way, Daniel is a direct descendant of Nathan Hale, interestingly enough. And so it's Daniel E. Hale, 26069-075. This is the inmate number, 26069-075. U.S. Penitentiary, P.O. Box 1000, Marion, M-A-R-I-O-N, Marion, Illinois, 62959. Now, listeners should go to his website, standwithdanielhale.org, and look at all the different, I don't know if you call them caveats or restrictions or what, but there's only so many things that you can send to Daniel. Like, it has to be a plain envelope, can't have any stickers on it, has to have a return address. You know, the Bureau of Prisons is very fascist, and so you've got to cross all your T's, dot all your I's, in order for him to receive that letter. Now, my understanding is, in the communications management unit that Daniel has, is his mail is restricted. I don't know how restricted it is, but I had heard that, you know, he couldn't even hold the letters in his hand, that they would put him on a overhead projector and project it up on a wall, and he could read it, and then it would go away.
Wow.
But I don't know. I haven't heard back from him, but anyway, he's serving the 45-month sentence, and we're hoping for a presidential pardon. President Biden did just pardon some people. I'm not exactly sure who they were, but it wasn't Daniel Hale. And, he is, again, a true American hero, and he does not deserve to be in prison for exposing this drone program, which is, it's rogue, it's out of control, and then that's why we go to Creech. And, again, to witness, to remember, probably one of the most powerful things for me there is being able to talk to guys and gals in uniform, face-to-face, when they are off base and they're going into like a 7-Eleven or stuff like that. I hang out there, other activists, we hang out, we have our, you know, Veterans for Peace vests on, Code Pink stuff, and talk face-to-face. Hey, there's another way. You don't have to be doing this. I even met a man this past time I was there who was a drone pilot, and he was getting out. He was not going to reenlist.
Good.
And darn it all, I didn't have my radio hat, my radio interview hat on, Chris. I didn't get his phone number, darn it all. But yeah, talking to these people face, because this is the only time they're going to hear it. I mean, they're not going to hear it. I mean, the base calls themselves, as bizarre and horrible as this is, home of the hunters. These people hunt other people,
yeah.
And they come in two shifts. There's no base housing there, because Creech Air Force Base, about 30 miles north of Las Vegas, is abuts the old Nevada test site, now the National Nuclear Security Site, where almost 1,000 nuclear weapons were exploded during the underground and above ground testing period. George H. Bush 41 stopped the underground testing. There hasn't been any since, except the stuff that they call subcritical. But anyway, so Creech Air Force Base has no base housing, so two huge shifts of people are driving back and forth, twice a day, to staff this base, the home of hunters. The pilots come to work in their flight suits, just like they're going to go fly an F-16 or something, and speaking of that, there's a very powerful play. I don't know where it is. It's called Grounded. It's a one-person play, and it's about a woman F-16 pilot who, in her third trimester, is grounded, as is standard operating procedure. You can't fly in your third trimester. And then there's time off to bond with the baby. And then she went back to work to fly her F-16. And they said, you're going to fly a drone. No more F-16s. And it's all about the stress that she experiences of operating these drones. They're 12-hour shifts. You may kill somebody that particular day, and drive home and have dinner with your family. It's a bizarre, right. Bizarre existence. That's the home of the hunters.
So I'm speaking with Don Kimball. He's a U.S. Air Force veteran, and he is the host of Friendly Fire, a voice for veterans for the last 4 years that broadcasts in Maine and New Mexico. And I just, when you were speaking, I was just reflecting on all the others that have also told the truth. Edward Snowden told the truth, Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, and these people are all silenced by the Espionage Act, and they're driven to become suicidal. And you know, it's a very terrifying thing to have whistleblowers that are so disregarded by their own government. I mean, we the people have to stick up for people who tell the truth. We need transparency. We need honesty. And I hope people will look at The Intercept, the publication is called The Drone Papers. You just have to Google that. And I think my last question for you, Don Kimball, is about the Predator drones that they fly out of Creech in the... With so much else going on in the world right now, we haven't had any news at all about where these weapons are still being used, or, you know, who is being killed now, who's being targeted. And do you have a better sense than I do from speaking with veterans and whistleblowers about what the current status of this horrible program is?
You know, Chris, I wish that I did, but I do have some good news, because on April 28th of this year in DeWitt, New York, Night Court Judge David Gideon, who was presiding, dismissed charges against two upstate Drone Action Coalition veterans charged for blocking the base. So this is Hancock in upstate New York. The drones also operate out of there. Creatures isn't the only place, and these charges were dismissed. So that's very good news. And one of the defendants, Mark, Mark Shibila Carver, just in court noted that, as we warned in court several years ago, he said the United States has developed low-yield nuclear weapons that can be delivered by MQ-9 drones.
Mm.
So we know that the technology is getting to be to the point where, yes, they can deliver nuclear, these drones can deliver nuclear weapons. All these drones are going to eventually be flown by artificial intelligence. Mm. There will be no human interaction.
Right.
This is the rise of the drones.
Right.
It's a very, very frightening time for humanity. I wish I knew what the answer was, but all I know is that we got to keep fighting. We got to keep talking about it. We got to get the word out there in community radio, shows like yours, stations like yours. This is how we do it. And then people spread the word from there, and you know, and get out in the streets. Because let's face it, most of the politicians. I mean, I'm old school. You know, I turned 70 in January, and so I'm still, you know, I'm not writing letters much anymore, emails to my elected officials, but I'm still calling them and complaining, and saying, hey. You know, we need to do X, Y, Z. We need to cease fire. We need to stop funding the Pentagon while people are, you know, sleeping in their shoes. You know the story, Chris. You work with the homeless a lot. You know what's happening. The homeless population is growing by leaps and bounds. Evictions are going up. People are hungry, and yet we have all this money to send to Ukraine. Now, I'm all for, you know, not letting the Ukrainians be massacred by Putin and Russia. I believe that we should support them. But, you know, at what point, it's a fine line, isn't it? You know, at what point do you say, okay, you know, let's stop sending them tanks and blah, 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 blah. Let's sit down and talk. So maybe it should be a dual purpose here. You know, we want to cease fire, first of all. We want to stop right now. But we also need to show some strength, because, I mean, if you look at, you know, what happened in Chechnya, Crimea, the Donbass region.
We have to end, Don. Can you wrap up? We have to go.
Yep. So, peace and love, everybody. Get out there and fight that good fight. Chris, thanks so much for having us on. Support Daniel Hale and all other whistleblowers. Reality L winner. Too, even though reality is out,
she's
still in a very severe 3-month probationary period. They wouldn't even let her go run a marathon for her 30th birthday. Probation officer.
Thank you so much, Don Kimble, for being my guest today. I really appreciate you and your work as a fellow programmer on community radio. Thank you.
Keep up the great work. Thanks, Chris.
Bye. All right, folks, stay tuned for Playing Dead, and thanks for hanging with us today. Peace and social justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Chico News and Review, hosting the best of Chico. Vote for your favorite Chico businesses by logging into newsreview.com/bestofchico. Voting begins on May 9th. The May issue also features local election coverage and more. The Chico News and Review, providing you your local news and entertainment for over 40 years. And by the Chico Racquet Club, Chico's premier tennis, sports, and health club. On May 20th to the 22nd, they'll be hosting the annual Spring Open Tennis Tournament. Anyone in high school or older can enter this event. Online registration is available at ChicoRacquetClub.com. Also available for online registration are the summer tennis and volleyball camps. More information is at ChicoRacquetClub.com or 530-895-1881. Okay, stay tuned for Playing Dead. Here's the community calendar first. And peaceful Mother's Day, everybody.
Hey, Hey, listeners, it's time for the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar with me, Megan Hammer. The Butte County Board of Supervisors Candidate Forum to discuss law enforcement issues will be held at the Chico Women's Club on May 5th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. It's hosted by Concerned Citizens for Justice. You can go to cc4jchico.org for more information. The Mother's Day plant sale and small gift sale will be located at 809 Nancy Lane in Chico. Friday, May 6th through Sunday, May 8th, visit the Erlin Ambassadors of Chico for their annual Mother's Day plant and gift sale to help benefit their scholarship fund. The sale will begin at 809 Nancy Lane on Friday, May 6th at 8 a.m. and continue through midday, Sunday.